It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So guess what the big food trend is in the Bay Area right now? Toast. Yeah, you heard me. Toast. Well, actually, they call it artisanal toast, which means it costs about $4 a pop. Now, to be clear, this is not a slice. It's more like a slab, but it's still $4. Julita Carelli, a woman who tattooed freckles on her cheeks, started this toast thing at her shop, Trouble Coffee and Coconut Club. Now, for her, each item has meaning. Toast is comfort, coffee is speed and communication, and coconut is survival, because you can live on it. There's nothing run-of-the-mill here. Stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. A couple of years ago, a man called in to get advice on a dream that I think a lot of people who love to cook have. Have a listen. We have Jeff calling. Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is about how an unknown like me breaks into the cookbook market with a book that I've written about a bread recipe I've taken 12 years to develop.
So you've written the book?
I've written parts of it. I've written the master recipe and I've written some of the variations. And I'll be a little bit immodest, and I'll say that it's a revolutionary concept. I'll go so far as to say that.
Okay.
It produces, I guess I would describe them as artisan-style loaves, you know, European-style hard-crusted breads.
Ooh.
And it only takes about 5 minutes a day. So it's the same convenience and speed of a bread machine, but you can't get a good crust on those.
Well, you're already,
Jeff,
you're already marketing the book. There's, I don't know how many million people listening, and they're probably sitting there and saying, gee, I really want to know about that. Okay, so you want to know how you go about marketing,
yeah,
you know, getting this cookbook to a publisher.
Right.
That's Jeff Hertzberg, who went on to write with Zoe Francois, the best-selling artisan bread in 5 minutes a day. Designed for the home cook, this book has turned more people into bakers than we could have ever imagined. Well, he joins me here in the studio with their latest, the new artisan bread in 5 minutes a day. So, Jeff, you did it. You did it big time. But how did you first get the publisher's attention?
It was unbelievably lucky. So we had that phone call, and I sort of laughed about it, and I thought about all the things you had said that obviously were never going to happen, like, oh, writing down recipes and testing them over and over and over again instead of just having it in my head. Because this, for me, was an escape from writing things down and being a scientist and doing all those things that I do
in my day job. Because you're a physician.
Right. I'm a physician. I work with computers now. I develop a software for healthcare, and I have to write everything down and do it the same way every time. And this is a creative outlet for me, and I didn't want to do any of that for this. And so we were unbelievably lucky because that little segment was overheard by an editor in New York, a woman named Ruth Cavan, who's now passed away, late Ruth Cavan, who was sort of seen as the mother of the American mystery novel. But she also had an interest in cookbooks and had published some of her own in the 1960s. When I met her in the 2000s, she was in her 80s already and still working at St. Martin's Press, which ultimately published all these books. And she called your producer, Jen, and said, can I talk to this guy because I want to get a book proposal? You were the gold charm.
Well, thank you.
And she called, and I laughed for a couple of days. My wife and I were hysterical. She's an editor, my wife is, and she said, this is never, I don't know, do you want this to happen? I said, well, yeah, I just don't want to do any other work. Because I had a day job. We had our second baby on the way. But I spoke to Ruth, who was a complete pistol, just hysterical person, incredible bundle of energy in her 80s. And she said, well, I want to do it. I said, but you haven't even heard how I kept it a big secret on the air with you how this is done, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
She said, oh, I trust you. She was just the kind of person who'd make a decision.
And then she'd follow through on it.
And she'd follow through on it. Uh-huh. The other lucky bit was 3 years after sort of blowing off this call with Ruth Cavan,
right,
I met Zoe Francois, who's a local chef here in Minneapolis, and she said, you have a book offer and you didn't do anything about it? So everybody she went to school with at the Culinary Institute of America, the CIA, would basically be furious to hear that, as was she. And she said, you have to do it. And I said, I don't have time. But would you do it with me? We had become friends at this point. Mm-hmm. And there's some convoluted story about how I wouldn't tell her the secret. I deny all of that until she tried it and was sold on the method.
Okay, let's get to the big secret because the new book is the new Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day. What's the basic theory behind this?
So the thing I started working on when I was a medical resident was, could you extend the time you store dough in the refrigerator longer and longer and longer? Because what that would, there's some simple arithmetic here. So you mix once, and if you could store a lot of dough, you would mix once and bake many times. And traditional bakers and professionals say you can't store. It's called the retard phase, R-I-T-A-R-D. It's good to slow it down and put it in the refrigerator.
That's what develops that deep, delicious flavor.
That's right. Yeah. It's from the byproducts of fermentation. And the traditional books all say you can, you know, a day of cold temperature is nice, even 2 days, maybe three. But beyond that, it loses all its rising power and it doesn't work. And nobody would ever challenge that little bit of orthodoxy. And because I wasn't a professional baker and wasn't yet associated with one, I messed around with that. I'd have mountains of dough in bins in the refrigerator that would basically come over the top of the bucket in plastic and glass buckets. If you use glass, don't seal it. It can explode.
Oh, my.
But basically, I extended that resting phase in the refrigerator to up to 2 weeks. And actually, when I met Zoe initially, it was up to a month, but she found that much too strong flavor. And I think she's right.
It gets sour.
It gets more and more sour. You develop sourdough character without having to go through the sourdough rigmarole of feeding and keeping it alive.
So your mixture is the essence of it's salt, yeast, water.
Flour.
Yeah. And you're making a very sloppy dough, right?
It is just wet enough so that it would hold a free-form shape like you see on the cover of the book, but not so solid that you couldn't do the trick. Because the key to the trick was it had to be pretty wet dough, or it turns into sort of a semi-solid sponge that you can't then manipulate in shape without losing all – it becomes much too dense.
I see.
So there was a perfect level of liquid. And a lot of people had played with no knead, by the way. So this is not a kneaded dough.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because five-minute bread was usually the no-knead method, which Mark Bittman had printed, developed by a baker named Jim Leahy in New York.
The first book on no-knead in the U.S. was a book called No Need to Knead in 1999, almost a decade before any of us started with this.
Really?
By a woman named Suzanne Dunaway out in L.A., a wonderful baker, and she took the traditional Italian method of no need, high moisture. So none of us invented, including Suzanne, none of us invented no need. In Suzanne's book, like Jim's, because it's mix once, bake once, it didn't really change the way bakers were able to use it at home because it's too much work for most people. You mess up the kitchen, you get flour everywhere. Mm-hmm. The key time-saving in ours that actually I'm surprised that nobody else has tried to write about is that you mix once, store it with the right hydration, and you can bake it over 2 weeks. And that's what's unique about
it. So you can keep scooping into that dough. You don't do anything else.
That's right.
You shape it properly, and it goes into the oven.
Well, it's got to rest again, and that's passive time, and that doesn't count in the 5 minutes a day. So passive time, and the passive time is short if you do a flatbread. It can be zero for a pizza.
Uh-huh.
But for a tall loaf, it can be 40 to 60 to 90 minutes.
And you're also doing a chapter in this book on gluten-free bread.
We do. All of our books, except for the very first edition of the current book in 2007, have had a gluten-free chapter because people came on the website and said, can I just swap gluten-free flour for your all-purpose? And the answer is no, it's not going to work. So we've developed those.
And the system is the same with gluten-free?
Yes. Yes, you mix it once. It's pretty wet, but not too wet, or it won't hold the shape.
Uh-huh.
And then into the refrigerator. The gluten-free store is not quite as long, 5 to 10 days at most.
Well, that's
but that's
not
pretty
bad.
Good.
That's not bad.
Right. So I've always got something in the refrigerator.
And that means really, in a short time, you can make bread every day.
I do it every day.
Yeah. So you have fresh bread every night.
Every morning or every lunch. When my kids were taking lunch to school, their typical bread for school lunch was a whole wheat pita flatbread. So there's you take it out of the refrigerator, roll it out. Didn't need any resting time. It went into the oven, and I had that on a time preheat so that when we woke up, it started preheating.
Uh-huh.
And when we came downstairs into the oven,
They had fresh baked bread to take.
Right.
That's showing off.
Right. It is.
That's showing off.
It's true. I don't know if the kids saw it as a status symbol. I'll have to ask them.
Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, and thanks for everything you didn't even mean to do but did for these books.
You're welcome. Jeff Hertzberg is co-author with Zoe Francois of the new Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a Day. Now, he left us with a basic recipe to get us going. You can find refrigerator-stored artisan bread on the website, splendidtable.org. Bread is called the staff of life for a reason. It's smack dab in the center of society, and it can be an agent for change as well as simply food. Think of those bread riots that started the Arab Spring. Well, there's a baker in Washington, D.C., who's using bread as his vehicle for personal change, and he's proving it's never too late to make a fresh start. Mark Furstenberg is 75, and he's opening a brand new bakery, Bread First. It's not something most of us would begin to consider at that point in our lives. Rebecca Shear paid a visit to the bakery, still under construction, and brings us the story.
If you step inside the spot, soon to be known as Bread First, see if I can open this door, you'll find yourself inside a bit of a construction zone.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm looking for Mark.
He's right there. See the old man.
The so-called old man here is baker, entrepreneur, and James Beard award-winning cook, Mark Furstenberg. I say so-called old man because even though the Baltimore, Maryland native is 75 years old...
Can I ask when your birthday is?
In June, I'll be 76.
He's throwing his entire heart and soul into launching Bread First.
Although I was clearly too old to do it, I really wanted to do it.
Too old? Why do you say that?
75-year-old people don't generally start businesses. 75-year-old people generally are in Palm Beach or Palm Springs. Or some palm.
But not Mark Furstenberg. I mean, he didn't even become a professional baker until his 50s. He worked for President John F. Kennedy. He wrote scripts for ABC News. He even headed a company that manufactured copper tubes. But in 1988...
I was working for the Washington Post, and I turned 50 and decided I didn't like what I was doing. I didn't like writing about other people's experiences. I wasn't ready to give up my own.
So, after an inspiring, if heated, conversation with his dear friend, then Congressman Barney Frank...
I can't repeat on the radio exactly what he said.
Furstenberg decided to take his longtime love of food...
and make it my profession.
As for what kind of food to focus on...
I was a parent of two teenage boys, and my sons and I carried a questionnaire door-to-door around the neighborhood asking people what they wanted. And those questionnaires came back, and people wrote all over them, why is there no good bread in Washington? I used to live in Brussels. We had wonderful bread. I used to live in California. We had wonderful bread. We want bread. And I, having been a home baker, thought, oh, I can do that. That was stupid.
Stupid?
It was not stupid to decide to do bread, but it was stupid to think that I knew anything relevant to baking it professionally.
So he apprenticed at bakeries around the country. And in 1990, he opened Marvelous Market, credited as the first Washington bakery to turn out European-style artisan bread. He sold it in 1993, and 4 years later, he opened the bakery cafe Breadline.
And when I sold the Breadline downtown, I expected to be finished as a baker. I wanted to be a consultant and coach.
But that gig didn't quite pan out, for one thing.
I wasn't very good at the consultant role.
And for another, in 2010, his older sister died. Carla Cohen had founded and owned the legendary D.C. bookstore Politics and Prose.
And had done something so wonderful for the city by creating a little institution that is valued by the city. And I thought, partly in her memory, but partly because of my having lived here for half a century, that I ought to try to leave a bakery in the city.
And that bakery is, of course, Bread First. One thing Mark Furstenberg is especially proud of is how the bread oven, food kitchen, and pastry kitchen will all be fully visible to customers.
I wanted to create as intimate a connection as I could between people and the baked goods so that adults and particularly children can watch the process.
And that's a big thing with Mark Furstenberg. educating people, helping them learn. That's why he enlisted 5 apprentices to help him open Bread First. Like Michelle Vaughn, a young attorney who dreams of opening her own neighborhood bakery.
I'm putting together a website for Bread First. There was a period of time where I was sort of overseeing the apprenticeship program. There was a period of time where I was participating in design and looking up vendors. So it's really been all over the map for me.
Same goes for Violetta Palchik, whose vast retail experience got her promoted from apprentice to Bread First's general manager.
You know, Mark was saying it's strange to have someone as old as he is opening the business, but I think we get 2 benefits. One is he has fresh ideas, even though he's an older man. You know, he's modern, and he also has all that experience. So you get someone who's creative and fresh and innovative, but you also get someone who has a lot of wisdom.
Mark Furstenberg says he plans on contributing his fresh ideas and wisdom full-time once Bread First opens this spring. But once the business is on its feet, he says, he'll pull back until eventually he'll sell it to his staff.
I may appear to all of you to be in good physical condition, but obviously I'm not going to be able to be doing this into my 80s. My strategy for trying to create something that is of value to the city over the long run is to sell it to the people who make it successful in the first place.
After that, he says he's not sure what he'll do. He may stick around D.C.
I've not lived anywhere else for 50 years.
Or he may not. But one thing is definitely for sure. You're not moving to Palm Beach or Palm Springs or whatever, are you?
No, I would be bored in Palm Beach.
Mark Furstenberg is the creator of Bread First in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection on WAMU. Well, you can put your bread to good use if you check out his recipe for garlic crostini with pancetta. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Muslim Chinese food and where do congressional vegetarians lunch? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There is yet another local Chinese cuisine to check out. I mean, will the discoveries never end with this country? The food is new to us, but it's ancient to the Chinese. It's Xi'an Muslim. Now, Xi'an was the ancient capital of China, and it was where the infamous Silk Road began. Hence, a big Muslim population that exists to this day. And intriguing dishes you taste practically nowhere else in China. But if you're in the New York area, you're in luck, because you can try one of the Xi'an famous food restaurants. Well, our commentator, Jennifer Eightley, talked with the founder's son, Jason Wang.
Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
So Americans know Chinese food in terms of Cantonese or Hunan or Sichuan, but Xi'an Chinese food is actually fairly unusual. What is it? How do you explain it to people?
Right. So Xi'an cuisine is actually not very well known, even in China. It's spicy. It's sour. It uses a lot of black vinegar. So we call it suan la, and that means spicy and sour in Chinese. It's just simple fare that's usually sold on the streets. You don't have time to eat. You're just going to grab a bowl of something or something on a skewer and just, you know, eat it on the run.
I actually first encountered Xi'an food when I was a student at Beijing University. And one of the strangest dishes I saw was liangpi. And it's an unusual dish because it's like a noodle, but it's not. Like, what is it?
Oh, yeah. Liangpi is definitely one of our signature dishes. It's sort of what I say to people is that it's the dish that really made us famous in the first place in New York. It's a vegetarian dish. It's made from wheat flour. It's a complicated process, but basically you're making chewy noodles out of the starchy part of the flour and the little cube things. It's seitan, the gluten of the flour. And you're pretty much just making these things separately from one block of dough. And after, you know, steaming it and cutting into noodles and, you know, cutting the seitan to pieces, you dress it with some sauces and some vegetables. And it's a really refreshing dish that's great for the summer. You know, again, it's one of those street dishes. Usually people sell it in carts in Xi'an. It's not a fancy dish, but it's definitely a very signature dish of Xi'an.
And I think a lot of Americans might not know where Xi'an is. It's the original capital city of China, and it's famed basically for its terracotta warriors. And it's because it's also in the western part of China. It actually has a high Muslim influence, like not only in the city, but also in the food. And like growing up in Xi'an, do you feel that in the food and the city?
Yes, definitely. I mean, around the city, there are, you know, Muslim Chinese are just like Han Chinese, you know, the dominant group in China, the dominant ethnic group, which I'm part of, I guess. But, you know, there's really no difference between us. It's just what we eat. And in Xi'an, you would find halal places, and they sell mostly lamb and a lot of dishes that are similar to what we sell in New York.
So why did your family decide to open a Xi'an restaurant?
Well, definitely it's just something that my father knew how to do, and that personally he sort of missed the food. And based on his family recipes, he knows how to make these dishes. And he decided to open it because he felt like there are people like him in the U.S. that miss this cuisine. When he chose the menu initially, it was all his doing. We focused mainly on the noodles and the burgers. So the noodles would be the cold skin noodles, the liangpi noodles. The burgers would be the buns with the meat in it, the flatbread buns with the meat
in it. The rojamul. My mom always asked me to bring that home for her
those
from Chinatown.
Easily, yeah, the lamb, the spicy Cuban lamb burgers, the stewed pork burgers. Their meat stuffed in like a flatbread type of bun. Those are definitely some of our signature dishes as well. And of course, the hand-ripped noodles. So not to be confused with hand-pulled noodles, which are thinner. Hand-ripped noodles are also called biang-biang noodles, and they're wider, they're more chewy because the noodles are thicker and they hold on to the flavors better. I'm getting hungry thinking about it. But yeah, those are some of our signature dishes. And it was great in the beginning. We saw this influx of people coming from Manhattan, coming from Brooklyn, basically everywhere where Chinese people are not. And it was sort of surprising in the beginning that, oh, everyone likes this type of food, not just the new immigrants like my father sort of, made the food for. But in the end, you know, people are people, and, you know, people will enjoy good food.
There's a dish that you have called paomo, which remind me of something I've seen in Iraqi cuisine.
Oh, yeah.
It's very unusual. It's definitely not a normal Chinese dish that you would see at your corner takeout.
Definitely. It's definitely a very famous dish. The lamb palmo soup, yang rou palmo. Basically, what it is you take sort of flatbread, that's stale bread, basically, and you would break that into bits, boil it with some lamb broth, with some thin glass noodles, and lamb meat. And you enjoy it with some pickled garlic and some chili paste, which is the traditional way that it's served in Xi'an.
Thank you so much, Jason, for joining us today.
Thank you, Jennifer. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Jason Wang is manager of the Xi'an Famous Foods in the New York area. Now, Jennifer A. Lee is the publisher of Daily Lit and the author of the Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Well, Jason left us with a taste of Xi'an. Look for his father's recipe for lamb dumplings. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. We know how wonderfully cooperative our Washington politicians tend to be when it comes to working out their differences. I don't need to list the details, but there is one issue where things may be different. It's the lunch issue on Capitol Hill. Reporter Marin Coggan came across a comment from a congressional aide, just a few lines, and it turned into her story for the New Republic. Hey, vegetarians, Congress doesn't like you. Marin, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So those few lines, what were they and who wrote them?
It was just a short blog post in one of the Capitol Hill newspapers about these congressional vegetarians who had attempted to get some better vegetarian options in the Capitol Hill cafeterias and had seen it turn into a big partisan special interest fight.
So what was the story here?
Well, a few months ago, a few of these Vegetarian Hill staffers were getting together and talking about how bad they thought their vegetarian options were on Capitol Hill. And so they did what like-minded people do in Washington. They decided to form a caucus. Now, the caucus was meant to be educational and bipartisan, but one of the first things they wanted to do was write the caterers of some of the Capitol Hill cafeterias and ask for a meeting introducing better vegetarian options onto the menus. They never heard back, but a few weeks later, a sign went up in one of the cafeteria buildings advertising a meatless Monday. So they were just going to have one kiosk in one of the cafeterias offering meatless options once a month. It turned into a huge partisan special interest fight that they never even asked for.
And what form did this fight take? And did this sign go up as a result of the letter that they wrote?
They never heard back, so they're not entirely sure. I did a little bit of digging around on this, and it turns out that it was just one catering staffer that just put up a sign. He was new to Capitol Hill and maybe didn't understand the political implications of this, but this one sign went up, and a farm industry lobbyist saw the sign, called another farm industry lobbyist, and they got together and wrote a letter on behalf of the Farm Animal Welfare Coalition, which is a coalition of different farm industry groups, decrying Meatless Monday as an acknowledged tool of the environmental and animal rights communities.
And did the environmental and animal rights communities respond to that?
Well, they weren't even aware previously that this was happening. So they sort of inadvertently found themselves in the middle of this fight. The caterers apologized immediately once it became controversial, and the vegetarians never heard anything back from them. Now, the vegetarians are saying, you know, we don't care about the Meatless Monday. We just want some better options on Capitol Hill. But they've sort of unwittingly found themselves in the middle of this big argument that they didn't ask for and that they, you know, hasn't solved any of their problems.
Now, I understand that as different parties come into power, what happens in the cafeterias changes.
Yeah, it's more of an ideological battleground than you might think. I remember in 2011, not long after John Boehner took over the House, and we all came into the cafeteria and found that the compostable cutlery and takeaway cases and cups that Nancy Pelosi had introduced in her time as speaker had been replaced with plastic and styrofoam. Even the coffee was different. So, you know, lunch in Washington looks a lot like everything else. It's really partisan.
Okay, so now wait. If the Democrats hold the Senate, is the Senate cafeteria any friendlier, for instance, to the vegetarians?
Well, you know, it really varies. There are so many different cafeterias on Capitol Hill, and, you know, most people just go to whichever one is closest. So the Senate one is smaller, but the House office building cafeterias tend to be a little bit better than the ones in the Capitol. It just depends on where you go.
And what are the vegetarian choices that they have?
Again, it depends on where you go. I eat most days out of the House Capitol cafeteria in the basement, and it's really just a salad bar or a grilled cheese. And you don't want to eat grilled cheese every day, or maybe you do, but it's not the best idea. So really, a salad bar is your only option. It's a little bit different in other office buildings, but I don't think any vegetarian would claim that they have wonderful options all over Capitol Hill.
So you cover Capitol Hill and you cover political issues. What's your long view of this?
Well, I think this small story about a group of Capitol Hill vegetarians trying to get better options in the place that they go to work every day is kind of evidence of everything that is wrong with Washington. It became a big theatrical partisan fight, and it didn't need to be. They just wanted better lunch. So if you're looking for evidence of why it is so difficult to do the legislative sausage making on Capitol Hill, just look at how difficult it is for these Vegetarian Hill staffers to get vegetarian sausages introduced in their cafeterias.
Thanks for talking with us, Maren.
Thanks for having me.
Maren Coggan is writer-at-large for National Journal. Jane and Michael Stern cannot pass up, if they tried, a promising truck stop, a clam shack, or a diner. They tell all at roadfood.com and here. Guys, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Hi.
So what's the latest find?
New favorite place.
New favorite place is in Tallahassee, Florida, right across the road from Florida A&M University, a place called Olean's. If you want a great breakfast in Tallahassee, Olean's is the place to go. I mean, a great and $5, $6, $7 breakfast.
And it's a soul food breakfast, Lynn. In fact, we were turned on to this terrific place by asking somebody where we should go for breakfast. And she said, well, do you want a place that's motherly and upright? So who could resist that?
I love it.
It's a, you know, a small, average-looking room. There's nothing especially amazing about it. But the thing that everybody orders is the Obama breakfast, which is a ton of food, of really good food for a few bucks.
Well, it was created in 2008. There was an Obama breakfast and a McCain breakfast. As we understand it, the Obama breakfast is still on the menu.
Well, what is it?
It's some of everything. It's eggs, grits, potatoes, toast, sausage, bacon, and ham.
And a big frittata-like thing that they call an omelet but doesn't look like an omelet. There's chicken and biscuits.
Chicken and waffles.
I'm sorry, chicken and waffles. And all the Hawaiian punch you can drink.
Oh, this is fabulous.
It's so great. And, you know, Michael and I are such incredible suckers for religious wall decor at restaurants that we eat in, only because there's a complete direct correlation between how many Jesus plates are on the window and how good the food is. So right over our booth, it said, try Jesus. If you don't like him, the devil will always take you back. these wonderful.
This is a new discovery to me.
Oh, absolutely.
No, but, you know, I realize I've never heard a restaurant critic ever mention that this is one of the criteria that you use in judging a place. I have to remember this.
Seriously, it is.
Absolutely. Especially in the South. I mean, it's in parts of the Midwest. I mean, the religious devotion of a restaurant is often a sign of religious devotion to good food. The two go together.
Even if it isn't religious, it's upright. In other words, some of our favorite places to eat in Memphis, the first thing you see when you walk in is a big sign that says no cussing. So, you know, if you want great food, you go to an upright restaurant.
So you started to say, though, that this place, Olin's, first of all, the chicken and waffles, I'm right with you. I mean, everything else sounds great, but you started to say something else about it.
Well, just what an enormous quantity of food you get. For the Obama breakfast, we also got fabulous cheese grits. And the guys who it's kind of like cafeteria.
It's cafeteria style, yeah.
And you point to what you want, or at least we pointed because they couldn't understand our northern accents, and we couldn't understand what they were saying, what the servers were saying. So after we got a big bowl of cheese grits, the guy kept saying, "Buh," and I said, "What? Buh," which was butter, you know, and so we were as, you know, unable to translate to Southernese as they were to Northernese, but the food was delicious.
Oh, by the way, if you do say butter, what they do is take a big brush, almost like a paintbrush size, dip it into some melted butter, and then just drizzle it on whatever you want your butter on.
Which is everything.
Oh, my. Oh, my. How's the fried chicken?
Oh,
it is the great dish in the house, as far as I'm concerned. The waffle is fine, but basically as a trivet for this superb fried chicken, they really know how to
do
it right.
Michael, I also love the smothered pork chops.
Yes.
They were terrific.
Yes.
That was part of the breakfast, too?
Well, it can be. That's not part of the breakfast, but you can get smothered pork chops.
I think that's more their lunch menu, and it's with candied ham. I mean, candied yams, not candied ham. Black-eyed peas, braised cabbage, mullet, fried chicken, chitlins. You know, it's a basic Southern soul food menu, but with the sweetest, nicest, most welcoming people that have served us food in years. Absolutely terrific.
It sounds fabulous, and I have to say, I mean, with that breakfast, you would just eat one meal a day. What a great way to diet.
Well, you would. Don't look at us.
Hey, thank you, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Now, don't miss the newest edition, the 9th, of their classic guide, Road Food. Information is at splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with your questions and what it's like to be in a cow's hooves. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to connect with you, 800-537-5252, or try email. Go to splendidtable.org. Harry is calling from Redwood Falls, Minnesota. Harry, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Oh, thank you. It's a real treat to speak with you, Lynn.
Well, thank you, sir.
My question is about a kind of unique object. A daughter and her family gave us for Christmas a Himalayan salt tablet, and it's a beautiful object. My wife has used it a couple of times to serve crudité.
Right.
And the crudité eaters have said, oh, my, those are salty. So I was just wondering if you could suggest some other pertinent uses for that beautifully aesthetic object.
What does it look like, Harry?
It's a large rectangular solid, probably 12 inches wide by about 16 inches long by about 3 inches high.
Well, I have to tell you, this is something that is very old yet quite new. Cooking on salt plaques or boards or whatever you want to call them is something that one man has done a book on, and his name is Mark Bitterman. And he has a shop, he has two shops, one in New York and one in Portland, Oregon, where he has every salt you could imagine from places you could never imagine. And one of the things that he discovered when he was in the Himalayas, this all started with him backpacking his way around the world and finding he was fascinated by how the different salts tasted and looked and whatever. At any rate, he started bringing in these salt slabs. And now, depending on where you live, you go into supermarkets and they're being sold. Now, one of the ways you can use this is that you can heat it up in the oven. You might put it on something like a cookie sheet or whatever, and you slowly heat it up, and then you put thin slices of it, maybe fish, it may be meat, it may be vegetables, and you can actually grill on it. So for instance, you might marinate slices of eggplant with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper and whatever herbs you like, and you get the salt very hot, and you then plop things on it. And if you go on our website, splendidtable.org, you can find the book. Bitterman is the author. And there's a recipe there. I think there's a couple of recipes. And it's really fascinating. You've got a treasure. This is going to open up a whole new way of cooking.
I think it probably is. And it's visually, it's a beautiful object. Thank you so much for your suggestions. And I will go to the website and glean some information from there. And great speaking with you. And I love your suggestions.
Well, thank you. And thank you for a great question.
Okay. Bye, Lynn.
Take care. We have got Zoa. And Zoa is out to sea. He's on the USS. Is it Mahan, Zoa?
Mahan.
All right. Well, what's your question? And where are you?
I'm on a Navy destroyer, and I'm in the Gulf of Mexico, heading to New Orleans. We're very happy to see the people in New Orleans here pretty soon.
I can imagine. So what's your question?
Well, last year I was in Cyprus, outside of Larnaca, in this beautiful little village where these ladies made these clay pots. She was making it by hand, and I was like, I got to have one of these clay pots. And then we went to this wonderful little restaurant where they cooked, you know, in the clay pot, and they brought it out with the stuff in there. And I've tried a couple times with the clay pot that I bought using internet research to get that same effect of the tenderness of the meat and the flavors of a pork or a lamb, and I have thus been unsuccessful cooking in an electric oven, soaking it in water and this kind of playing around with it, but I haven't got there yet.
You know, they just handed me photographs. Evidently, you sent photographs. Oh, this is beautiful. Okay, so essentially this is a thick clay cylinder. More or less straight sides with small handles on the side and a slightly domed lid with a knob handle. It's pretty simple. But, you know, one of the ways that these pots are often used is on heat where you do, you soak it, but then you can put it on a burner with very, very, very low heat that you very gradually bring up the temperature, really gradually. And you cook.
Got it.
Yeah. You braise in olive oil and you do it really slowly. I have one that's, now this is not glazed, right? This does
it
not
have, unglazed.
Yeah, it's unglazed. I have a glazed pot from Spain where I do most of my beans. But this will work in a similar way. That act of cooking with a bit of olive oil, and what I do with the beans is I chop up celery, carrot, and onion, and garlic, and whatever herbs I want, and they get sautéed really slowly, and then the soaked dried beans go in with a bit of water, you know, and they cook. But I've also done stews that way, and it's that slow, slow, slow cooking, it seems. You can probably get a similar effect in the oven, but you were saying you really tasted something about the pot in that food.
Yeah, you taste a little, it seems like you do taste a little bit about the earthen taste of clay kind of in there, not overbearing in any way, shape, or form,
but you
really taste it.
I know what you mean. Part of that, too, is that pot begins to absorb flavors. And as it gradually absorbs flavors, it lends flavor and lends that quality of the literally the taste of the earth that the clay comes from to the food. So the more you use the pot, no matter how you use it, in the oven or on top of the stove or on a grill, you're going to get more and more taste out of it. So that's the other element to, you know, look forward to. So I think it's a case where you have a newbie pot.
Okay, well, I will keep using it and keep experimenting with it.
Do you actually use it when you're at sea?
No, actually, I have, I don't use it at sea. We have very... You know, that'd be a whole other show to tell you about our small spaces and our limited ability to cook for large amounts of people. And you could probably come see that. I'm sure you could do awesome things with our sailors and teach them how to.
Don't tempt me. This sounds
utilize those small spaces with limited time and feeding lots of people.
I see from the note I've gotten that you're the commanding officer of the ship. How many people are under you?
We have about 280.
Feeding 280
people. I'm running
people.
A restaurant for about 900 meals a day, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and midnight rations. And we have a great supply department that does that. Probably about 15 cooks.
You know, this would be a great show.
If you ever want to come see us, we would love to have you on board. It would be great. We invite you anytime to come to Norfolk and come see what it's like. The challenge to feed 270 hungry sailors a day is pretty exciting.
Well, I think, you know, a little bit I know about the setups that exist on ships. Is that the call to lunch, or is it something else? Is that the call to lunch, or is it?
That was my sailors are doing drills now. You just heard that over the speaker.
Oh, I see. But I was just going to say that anyone who has a small kitchen and is trying to figure out the most efficient way to design it should go on board a ship like yours.
Actually, as a side note, I have a friend that is a chef who's on board. And he said, where is a pot? Because all we have are large kettles. I don't think you have a pot on board here.
Thanks so much for a great call. And keep using the pot. You know, you can make oatmeal in the blessed thing. Just keep using it, and it's going to give you a lot. Those people have been using those pots forever, and that's where all that flavor came from. You're going to love
it. I will
do that. Thank you. Take care. Bye. If you want to know how to work in a tiny space and make a kitchen that'll really function, look up galleys, ships' galleys. And one of the interesting things is that the most efficient design of its time for ships' galley that supposedly actually became a model for future warships was done by a cook to Queen Victoria in the 1800s. And his name was Alex Soyer. And he did a couple of things. Number one, he had incredible soup kitchens all over London for people in need. This is the chef to the Queen taking time to do this. And the other thing is that he designed all of the galleys for the Royal Navy. And that they had never worked that efficiently before. So for some fun history in kitchen design, look up Alex Soyer, S-O-Y-E-R. Stanford University is doing avatar studies. Now, instead of becoming a large blue humanoid with Dr. Spock ears and using a flying dragon for transportation, you become a cow. Yeah, a cow. It's all about empathy. You know the saying, walk a mile in someone's shoes? Well, it's hooves in this case. And heading up the project is Dr. Jeremy Baylinson. He's a cognitive psychologist and founding director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. Jeremy, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jeremy, there's been a lot of talk about this cow study, that it's about political stances, that it's about animal rights. What is it actually about?
This study is about empathy. In my lab for 10 years, we've been experimenting on, can you make somebody feel more empathy for another if you have them walk a mile in the shoes of their avatar? So the first study we ever ran was back in 2005, and we had normal-aged subjects, people who were around 18 or 20, normal for a college context.
Right.
They had them occupy avatars of the elderly, people who were clearly in their late 60s, early 70s. And the point of this study was to reduce ageism. So it turns out an 18-year-old has got some pretty stereotyped notions of what it's like to be 65.
Mm-hmm.
And what we demonstrated is by putting college-age students in an older avatar, having them look in a virtual mirror and see their face transform into someone that's much, much older, having their older version of them move with them in the mirror so it really felt like this was their identity, this tool caused them to feel empathy towards their future self. Consequently, later on, when they had an opportunity to interact with someone who was older, they actually became less ageist. The stereotypes that they had towards the elderly were reduced.
So how do you test that, though?
In the lab, we take great pains to measure behaviors that are natural, that participants don't know are part of the study. So, for example, with the ageism study, there's a standard way to measure these attitudes. For example, you have them write a paragraph, and we analyze the way that they use these words, or they have to fill in blanks in sentences, and we look at the automatic associations they have when they look at older faces. And these are kind of standard manners of getting attitudes that are implicit.
So what happened with the cow experiment?
With the cow study, I had a student named Joshua Bostic who entered my office. He was a master's student here at Stanford, and he said, Jeremy, I want to do a cow study. I want to have people become cows. We'd done lots of work, for example, with race, with gender, with age, where we showed that if you had occupy the avatar of another person, that you showed empathy toward them, but no one had ever tried this with another species.
So what did these students experience? You know, I'm walking into your lab. I'm going to be part of this study. What happens?
You walk into my lab, and we show you this room that has cameras all along the ceilings that can track the way that you move, and then you get on your hands and knees. We put lights on your hands and lights on your back and lights on your head. These are special lights that the cameras can see to track how you move in a room. You then put on a head-mounted display that replaces what your eyes see,
right.
And there's an array of speakers that can actually move sounds around the room. And wearing this head-mounted display, you see yourself as if in a mirror, not as a human being, but as a cow avatar.
So what am I going to do as a cow now in this experiment?
In this experiment, it lasts about between 5 and 10 minutes. You're told what it's like to be a cow that's raised for dairy and for meat, and you participate in some activities. You go down to a trough and you put your head down and pretend to drink some water. You amble over to a pile of hay and you put your head down and you pretend to eat hay. As you're going from one spot to another, you're actually seeing your cow get a light prod from a cattle prod, and you're feeling a slight poke in your chest from a stick in your side. So in other words, you're seeing your cow get poked and you're feeling a slight poke in your physical side,
mm-hmm.
just to urge you from one destination to the next. So after about 5 or 10 minutes of walking around the physical room, seeing yourself virtually walking around like a cow and doing things that cows tend to do, you're told that at this point it's time to go to the slaughterhouse. And what you hear is a truck backing up. The truck slowly backs up, and you hear the boop, 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 boop as the truck backs up. And you're asked to walk a few feet over towards the truck where it's coming from.
And do you actually go on the truck?
You do not go on the truck, so we don't actually take you to a slaughterhouse. At that point, the experiment ends, and we take you out of virtual reality.
So how do people react when that truck comes?
Subjects were fairly affected by this. Nobody was traumatized. Nobody was depressed. Everybody was fine. But the emotions that they had were fairly predictable in terms of empathy.
Really interesting. Now, the aftermath of this,
Has any of this changed people's eating habits?
So in this experiment, we actually measured what people ate the day before and the day after the study. We had them keep food diaries, and we're currently analyzing that data.
Well, Jeremy, the ultimate goal of all of these studies about empathy, is this something to perhaps place in school environments or in training environments?
In general, there's so much virtual content that is horrible and violent. If you think about the amount of time that children spend playing video games, to put it in perspective, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study in 2010. Kids on a daily basis spend twice as much time playing video games as they do reading print. The problem is that content is typically not what you want kids to be. And it's certainly not my place to judge what anybody looks at online, but it would be nice to create some content where people can learn to show empathy towards other people and animals as opposed to, say, shoot them. And there's nothing wrong, in my opinion, of trying to create content that's designed to have people be more helpful, to show more empathy, and to be nicer to other people and animals.
Jeremy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jeremy Balanson is a cognitive psychologist, and he's founding director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next time. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous. When a cow laughs, does milk come out of her nose? The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there for you at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Special thanks this week to audio engineer and digitizer Scott Adamson. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.